Right now, I'm joined on the phone by Phyllis Bennis. She is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book Challenging Empire: How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. She also recently issued some talking points on the current crisis, which are available at the Institute for Policy Studies website at ips-dc.org. That's ips-dc.org. I'm very pleased to be joined by Phyllis today. Hello.
Good to be with you.
Maybe we could start off by getting an overview of the current situation. Maybe you could fill my listeners in on what your understanding of the current up-to-the-minute situation is in Lebanon, Gaza, and Israel.
The situation is very dire. Civilians have been dying across the region in very large numbers in Lebanon and Gaza, in smaller numbers in Israel. The effort at diplomacy that was taking place this afternoon involving Javier Solana, the European Union's foreign minister, as it were, who was negotiating with the Lebanese prime minister, did not go far enough. The problem that we face is that this is a region in which all of the relevant actors, all of the relevant countries and areas, are led by very weak leaders. Leaders who have to prove their military credentials because they don't have them. In Israel, Ehud Olmert, the prime minister, is a disciple of General Ariel Sharon, but he's not Sharon, and he doesn't have any of Sharon's military credentials, as they call them, in Israel. In Syria, Bashar Assad is the son of the longtime Syrian leader Hafez Assad, and does not have his father's credibility with either the military or the intelligence agencies. In the Palestinian territories, first of all, of course, half of the elected government are in prison. You do have a growing unity between the two main political parties, Hamas and Fatah, but at the same time there is a kind of contention between the internal leaders, Abu Mazen from Fatah and Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas, with the external Hamas leadership based in Damascus. And in Lebanon, the government there, led by Prime Minister Fuad Senyora, is a very, very fragile government holding on by the skin of its teeth and could fall at any moment. So this is not a recipe for good, strong, statesmanlike behavior and diplomacy. This is a moment when the effort to prove one's mettle is taking priority, particularly at a moment when Israel has had from the United States a very clear green light. And in fact, the Israeli military has been very open in saying that the quiet response from the international community is what has given them a green light to go forward with their attacks in Lebanon and in Gaza. One of the real dangers, of course, beyond the existing clashes going even further, is that the Lebanon clash, which of course threatens on an immediate level the possibility of a region-wide conflagration if Syria and or Iran should become involved, for instance. There's the serious danger already that we're seeing that the crisis in Gaza, which is escalating on an hourly basis as well, is falling off the agenda. Nobody is paying attention to it. The G8 summit, which issued a very weak statement calling for an end to the violence without any clarity and without sort of saying that Israel stands in direct violation of international law, first for its expansion of attacks to the civilian areas, but there was no recognition of that. But there was also a much more diminished recognition of the crisis in Gaza. So I think that there's a number of crises, and most significant, of course, is the humanitarian one facing people in Lebanon, in Gaza, and in northern Israel, and particularly now in several towns in northern Israel that are largely Palestinian towns, including the ancient city of Nazareth, which is a predominantly Palestinian town which has now been hit for the first time just in the last couple of hours by Hezbollah rockets. So this is a dramatically escalating crisis, and I think the only reasonable call at this point is for the violence to stop on all sides.
What do you think the chances are of a region-wide conflagration? You said if Syria and Iran somehow became involved, that this could could lead to that. What do you think the chances of that are at the moment?
Well, I don't think we know yet. Some of it depends on what posture the United States takes. Right now, the U.S. is making very grandiose statements about Syria, claiming that they are holding Syria responsible, but without being willing, for example, to talk to the Syrian leadership. Syria is saying, we did not provide the arms and support for Hezbollah and tell them what to do. Iran is also saying that they were not involved in the decisions of Hezbollah to carry out the original attack. What we should be clear on here, there are violations of international law underway by all sides. I think it's very clear that the Israeli violations are on a far greater scale. Israel has a military capacity that far surpasses any of the others in the region. But there have been, in targeting civilian cities, and ironically Palestinian cities, by targeting civilians, Hezbollah as well has violated international law. The question of the involvement of Syria and Iran are more from the vantage point of their longstanding political and economic support for Hezbollah, and on the case of Iran, having provided some of Hezbollah's weapons. But this was, in my view, a very irresponsible act. Actually, the French foreign minister had a very good way of distinguishing between the Hezbollah action and the Israeli responses. He said that Hezbollah's seizure of the soldiers was a, quote, irresponsible act, while Israel's bombing of the international airport in Beirut was what he called a disproportionate act of war. The danger of it spreading even further is very, very serious. Iran has said that if there is an attack on Syria, that they would view that as an attack on what they said would be the entire Muslim world. It was interesting that they were not saying the Arab world. They said the Muslim world, implying that they would take it as an attack on them as well, and that there would be very serious consequences. Syria at the moment is remaining quiet. There was Israeli bombing in Lebanon right at the Syrian border, but the Israeli bombs did not cross the Syrian border. They did not attack Syrian territory, and so far Syria has been silent and has not said that they would enter. The danger is, of course, that would pull other governments into it. It raises the stakes, particularly for civilians who would be caught in a much heavier crossfire, but it also raises the possibility of a much longer war. Right now, this is still something where if, for example, the U.S. were to intervene in a serious way and make clear to Israel that they need to pull back out of Gaza and stop their bombing of targets in Lebanon while engaging in negotiations over the release of the three soldiers that are now being held by Hezbollah, as well as the 9,000 Palestinian prisoners for whom this kind of exchange is an old story in Israel. You know, the recent Israeli claim that we don't negotiate with terrorists, we don't negotiate with Hezbollah, is frankly nonsense. Israel wrote the book on negotiating with Hezbollah and others, with Hamas, others that they consider terrorists, to engage in prisoner exchanges. This is an old story. There's absolutely no reason why they couldn't do it again, particularly given the public pressure that is rising inside Israel, led by the father of the first soldier that was captured off the Gaza border, who has said deliberately that Israel should negotiate for his son's release and the release of the other soldiers. So this kind of call, along with a recognition, as France and Russia and Italy have all said at the G8 summit and elsewhere, Israel has been violating international law, has gone too far. It is not an act of legitimate self-defense. You know, this original claim that Israel makes that, well, they started it. That's the Israeli mantra. They started it. They began it. One, it's always a question of when do you start the clock when you're looking at choosing an incident to claim started anything. But the other side is, even if one assumes that we want to claim this particular crisis began with the capture of the two Israeli soldiers over the Lebanon border skirmishes happen all over the world on a daily basis. border skirmishes between Israel and Lebanon is not a new story. A border skirmish and the capturing of two soldiers is not a declaration of war in the real world. Israel chose to make it such, and they launched a war by attacking on a massive scale civilian targets, shutting down the airport, destroying the runway, targeting civilian neighborhoods, killing, among others, the eight Canadian citizens outside of Beirut. So the level of this attack in response to a very common kind of border clash is really at the root of the current crisis.
I'm sure there are people, though, who would respond, well, if, say, a Canadian group, I'm not going to say it's the government, because Hezbollah is not the government in Lebanon, but if some Canadian group came across the border and captured a couple of U.S. soldiers and killed eight soldiers, don't you think the response here against Canada would be pretty major? Or
I hope that we would not respond by bombing downtown Toronto and shutting down Montreal's international airport.
Blowing
I hope
up.
That we would engage in negotiations for the return of the captured soldiers. If nothing else, the war in Iraq should have taught the Israelis the lesson that most other people around the world, military analysts and others, have long learned, that you can't win by military force an insurgency. You can't defeat a popular militia that has popular support. I would point out that Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. They are one of the largest parties in the Lebanese parliament. They have two ministers in the Lebanese cabinet. So the question is, why didn't Israel immediately call the Lebanese prime minister and say, we've got to talk. This is outrageous. We've got to negotiate over this. This can't go on. There was no effort. The first Israeli answer was the bombing of the international airport.
Well, what do you think the likely response would have been from the Lebanese government if Israel had made some attempt to negotiate through them to get the soldiers returned? It's likely that the Lebanese government might respond by saying, well, we can't control Hezbollah. I mean,
that would have certainly been part of their response. But then the next step would have been, how do we engage directly with Hezbollah and negotiate with them, as Israel has on so many occasions in the past? They got the release of an Israeli businessman. This was in 2004, an Israeli businessman that had been held captive by one of the militias in Lebanon, along with the remains of 20 soldiers that had been killed during the years of the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon that went on for 18 years. We shouldn't forget that. They negotiated with no problem for in a prisoner exchange. They got the release of that businessman and the remains of the soldiers in return for the release of some number, I forget the exact number, of both Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners from Israeli jails. This is not rocket science. They could have done that in a minute. The point was that they had a set of political goals that went far beyond the return of the soldiers. The soldiers' families are saying, negotiate to bring our boys home. It's the Israeli government. It's not the military itself. It's the government is choosing the targets and making the strategic decisions that are basically saying, our goal is to destroy Hezbollah, establish unchallenged Israeli military control over our borders, and ensure that Hezbollah, as either a political or militia organization, is going to be destroyed. They were looking for a time and a way to justify doing that. The plan, they've admitted, was in place months ago. I think they said 2 to 3 months ago this plan was already in place. They were waiting for an excuse. And the very irresponsible act by Hezbollah gave them that excuse.
Now, these prisoner exchanges you're saying have taken place in the past. I'm sure there are plenty of people who would argue that set a dangerous precedent that encourages terrorists to capture, to capture people and kill people to get their ends met. And then if you reward them, then they'll do it again.
Well, the question then becomes, what do we do about the 9,000 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli prisons? Are they being held by terrorists who have their own political motivations? I would say yes, and we need to negotiate for their release as well. This is a two-way street here.
Okay. Well. Okay. Well, back up your assertion that they're being held by terrorists, which is what
I
you just
said. I asked the question: are we saying that they're being held by a terrorist state?
Okay. Are you
I
saying
think
that?
that Israel has committed acts of state terror, absolutely, and that includes the arrest of many, many Palestinians. I don't have the numbers in front of me, although B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, does, who they have acknowledged they are holding as bargaining chips for precisely this kind of a scenario, for the exchange of prisoners. This is an old story between Lebanon and Israel, and between Palestinians and Israel. This is not something new and different. And to claim that all of a sudden this is going to establish a precedent, there's a 25-year-old precedent. It's been set. Whatever one thinks about the precedent, it exists. So when Ehud Olmert goes up and says, we don't negotiate with terrorists, we don't do prisoner exchanges, he's simply being, I'll be charitable and say, disingenuous. If I wasn't being charitable, I would say that's just an outright lie. The problem is he does not have the kind of credentials where he can negotiate a diplomatic, political solution without looking weak. And he heads a new party that was created when Ariel Sharon was around to lead it. And as long as Sharon was around, that new party was everybody's favorite. Now it's led by Ehud Olmert, who simply doesn't have the credibility. So he's faced with a huge dilemma. He either risks losing his public support but gets back the prisoners, or he maintains his political support, which in Israel has historically required taking militarized positions, and he risks not ever getting the prisoners back.
I want to, you know, talk about the Palestinian prisoners that you mentioned, the 9,000 in Israeli jails,
mm-hmm.
as well as the I believe it's only a handful of Lebanese prisoners that Hezbollah is saying that they
yeah,
would...
Yeah, it's a very small number.
I think it's like three or four, I'm not totally
Something
sure,
like that,
but
yeah.
these prisoners... maybe you could start with the Lebanese prisoners and then turn to the Palestinians. What are they in prison for? Because you'll
well,
hear...
some of them, as I said, have been picked up specifically as bargaining chips for future negotiations. There's a few who have been actually tried and convicted in an Israeli court. Those are not courts as we understand them. They're Israeli military courts with very few rights for the defendants. I think that there are serious issues of legitimacy of those courts, but the numbers who have been convicted in Israeli courts are a very small percentage of the 9,000. The much larger percentage are being held on various administrative detention arrangements where they are picked up in the occupied territories for one or another violation. Some are charged but have never been convicted and don't ever come to trial, are just held indefinitely. Charged with crimes. Many of them, the majority, have never been charged with anything, and they are being held administratively. So, and of course, we know that about 300 are women, and almost 200, it's about 180-something, are children under the age of 18 who are being held as prisoners. So, the Israelis have a pretty easy start to look at who they might want to negotiate to get the release of their three soldiers. These are not soldiers that we're talking about being held in military conditions. These are civilians.
I'm speaking with Phyllis Binnis. She is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. She recently issued talking points on the current crisis that we're talking about today in Lebanon, Israel, and Gaza. And those are at ips-dc.org. That's for the Institute for Policy Studies, ips-dc.org, to read those talking points. Phyllis, this situation has gone far beyond the two captured Israeli soldiers that are being held in Lebanon and the one in Gaza. It's gone far beyond that. In fact, as you've pointed out already, started long before that, but it's definitely a much bigger situation now than that, because you have it's escalated for one thing into almost an all-out war between Lebanon and Israel at the moment, and then you have Olmert, the prime minister. Last I heard, there might be something new since, but he has stated, I believe it was on Friday, that their new terms in order to end the siege, the bombings, and the stranglehold they have on Lebanon, that they're going to end that only when the Lebanese government disarms Hezbollah, or Hezbollah disarms themselves. And there was a number of other
The key
terms.
One was the full implementation of UN Resolution 1559, which is the resolution that had to do with demanding the withdrawal of Syrian troops from Lebanon. And in that context, it also demanded that the Lebanese government exert its control over the entire territory of Lebanon, including disarming Hezbollah and sending its own troops to the south, to the border with Israel. The Lebanese prime minister has made clear that he doesn't have the capacity to do either one of those things. I think that there is the possibility, and I think the reason that Israel put that forward as the basis for a ceasefire, meaning that's what has to happen before negotiations can begin, is that they know that's impossible. They're not going to get that without negotiations. So it means that they're not done yet, as it were. They're not done with their military attacks yet. They don't want to stop the firing. They don't want to negotiate yet. The casualties that they're taking in Israel, clearly they're prepared to continue taking. They're much smaller. They're on a much tinier scale than the casualties going on in both Gaza and Lebanon, although that could change. But so far, they've been at a qualitatively different level. And I think that that's the message. When Israel says that before we even will begin negotiations, we want full implementation and the release of the soldiers and the deployment of Lebanese troops to the south, they know that's not possible. So it's a statement that we really are not ready yet for serious negotiations.
What of the I'm thinking here that maybe what the Israeli leaders are thinking, now I could be, you know, completely wrong, but maybe what they're thinking is if the Lebanese government can't do it, then Israel will.
That's their rhetorical claim. That's what they claim all the time. If Lebanon won't do it, we will. The difference is Lebanon is facing a political crisis that grows out of 18 years of Israeli occupation, followed by several years of Syrian control and domination, if not full occupation. The Lebanon state is very, very weak. It's barely holding on. It doesn't have the capacity to challenge on an equal basis, let alone on a superior basis, the existing militias that exist. It's all very well and good for the Security Council to issue orders for Lebanon to do that, but it simply doesn't have the capacity to do it. That does not give Israel the right to bomb Beirut's international airport and to bomb villages, as they just recently did in the Shouf Mountains, two villages where they drop leaflets advising people, quote, advising, to leave, and then bombed a convoy where two families, including nine members of one family and seven members of another family, were killed as they tried to flee the village. They do not have the right to do that because the Lebanese government is too weak to disarm Hezbollah on their own. They did have the right, at the moment when their troops were seized, they had the right to cross that border in what's known legally as hot pursuit and try and get their soldiers back. That would have been a legal response.
They did that, didn't they?
No. Well, they did, and they failed.
They had a tank blown up.
They failed to get them back, and then their response was to attack the Lebanese capital, destroy the airport, and begin these massive attacks on civilian targets. They were by far the first to attack civilians. Even after the attacks in Gaza, they were the first to use it on the Lebanon side. The initial Hezbollah attacks had been against a group of soldiers at a base.
You've already
illegal, absolutely illegal, and ill-advised, and irresponsible.
You've already kind of talked about this, but what should they be doing as an alternative to this all-out assault? And
there should be a region-wide set of peace talks. We need a new peace process that brings in all the regional players and is, in fact, based on the regional call, I think, from the Arab League, which was issued in 2002, that set the terms for a long-term, just and comprehensive peace in the region, including full normalization of Arab states with Israel, that was predicated on the withdrawal of Israeli troops and settlers from all the territories occupied in 1967. That's a huge concession on the Arab side, which never gets recognized. It's a concession that 78% of historic Palestine is permanently lost and becomes Israel, and that only 22% of historic Palestine remains Palestinian. And yet, that's been the concession they're willing to make. So the, you know, the question of what should happen is talking, negotiating on an international level with the UN at the center, not the United States, whose position in this is so much focused on maintaining the ability to claim that its destructive war in Iraq is somehow leading to democratization throughout the rest of the region, and that is willing to accept the Israeli definitions of what is self-defense and what is legitimate use of force, using, we should note, U.S.-supplied military equipment. The planes, the attack helicopters, the missiles, the Hellfire missiles, and all the others all come from the United States. They are paid for with our tax money. One of the ironies, of course, in the Gaza situation is that the Israeli destruction of the Gaza electrical generating plant, that plant was bought by a U.S. company that happens to be named Enron. When it was destroyed by U.S.-purchased planes paid for by U.S. tax dollars, the current owners, a Connecticut company that bought out Enron, went to the United States government and said they are expecting $48 million in insurance money to rebuild their plant that was destroyed by U.S.-supplied planes and missiles. So there's this irony piled on irony of the U.S. Position in all this.
I want to turn the conversation at this point to Gaza, since we've been talking a lot about Lebanon. We have talked about Gaza a little bit, but maybe you can, you've already described the present situation as you understand it as a humanitarian crisis. A lot of civilians have been killed. But let's turn to the overall picture. Going back before the capture of the Israeli soldier by the militant wing of Hamas, which is supposedly the starting point for this whole thing. Let's go back a little bit further back, as far back as you would like to, and just
well,
give
let's
us
go back just a couple of months to the taking power in Gaza of the Hamas-led government. That triggered, despite the fact that European Union observers and American observers and all the foreign observers acknowledged that it was by far the most free and fair election that had been held in recent years in anywhere in the region, obviously undermined by the fact that it was still held under military occupation, but nonetheless, the Palestinians ran it themselves, and it was a free and fair election according to all the international judgments. The response to that, because the U.S. in particular rejected the decision of the Palestinians of the, in their democratic election, the result was a complete political and particularly economic isolation and embargo imposed on the Palestinians, not only in Gaza, but in the West Bank as well. But the impact was far greater in Gaza because the levels of poverty and unemployment were so much harsher existing in already in Gaza. The closure of the territories that had followed the removal of Israeli settlers and soldiers from the streets of Gaza was in a situation where it had been replaced largely by, it was no longer a traditional occupation. It was now what we might call a besieged territory. It became a large prison. People were free to move around within the Gaza Strip, but they couldn't get out. Goods and services could not come in or get out. The economy was absolutely stagnant. Unemployment was rising above the 50% mark at the official level. The UN was already talking about a growing humanitarian crisis. And in response to that, you have a scenario where the United Nations humanitarian agencies on the ground are now saying that catastrophe is looming in the next couple of weeks, particularly as the fuel stocks are depleted for the private generators that are all that remains to provide water and electricity to the entire Gaza Strip. When the Israeli planes destroyed the electrical generating plant, that stripped 860,000 people of electricity and most of them of water because the pumps depend on electricity to operate. Gaza, as I think your listeners probably know, is one of the most densely populated pieces of Earth on the planet. And the question of what will be the impact, I think, goes back to that pre-existing state of siege and embargo that has already had such a devastating effect on the people of Gaza. So when you put on top of that the kind of military siege that has been imposed in recent days, where the Strip has been divided by Israeli military troops now into basically three parts, the bridges destroyed, the water treatment plants destroyed, the electrical generating plants destroyed. What is emerging in Gaza is the kind of humanitarian crisis that we saw for so many years in sanctions-driven Iraq, where children were dying by ultimately the hundreds of thousands in Iraq. It could be in the tens of thousands in Gaza if the situation continues with insufficient access to water, to electricity, to medical care, to medicine. So the situation is absolutely dire.
And going back just about a month before the capture of the Israeli soldier again by the militant wing of Hamas, you had a targeted assassination, as they like to call them, of someone who had just been appointed in the Hamas government. And then you had, following that, the shelling deaths on the beach, after which the Hamas got involved in some of the rocket attacks mm-hmm. on Israel, and you had a huge spike and escalation in that. All these things seem to be connected to what escalated into what's happening now, if you ask me.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. The attack on the beach was a huge one, where a family was killed on the beach at Gaza. The assassinations, these so-called targeted assassinations, which represent a very specific violation of a specific set of articles in the Geneva Conventions, which set out the obligations of an occupying country like Israel over an occupied population. Those assassinations have totaled over 350 people dead. Of those, about 125 were not the target at all. So even this term, targeted assassinations, becomes a complete misnomer for murder. I mean, it's really another word for murder, because among them have been many children. Even a couple of years ago, while I was traveling in the occupied territories, there was an assassination of Sheikh Salah Shahada from Islamic Jihad, and he was indeed killed, but along with him, 14 other people were killed, of whom 11 were children under the age of 12. Now, that should have been no surprise to anybody, because the Israelis chose to target him in a very crowded apartment building at 3 o'clock in the morning, when everybody in the building was asleep. So what a surprise that most people were killed. I mean, it's just a shocking, amoral approach to claiming that this is somehow a legitimate military or political weapon.
It's also illegal under international law, the targeted assassinations.
Exactly. Any assassination. The Geneva Convention language is that killing under any circumstances is illegal.
So the embargo you mentioned on Gaza, my understanding is that a large part of the money that is being withheld from Palestinians is their own tax revenues.
Exactly.
About $50 million.
That's about $50 million a month.
Can you talk about that?
Israel collects in duty taxes, because everything that goes into Gaza has to go through Israel, essentially. And Israel collects the tax revenue and is supposed to turn it over automatically to the Palestinian Authority. The last several months, they have refused to do that, and one result is that the vast majority of the 140,000 or so civil servants who work for the Palestinian Authority have not been paid. Each of those people supports, on average, 15 others, extended families, friends, because unemployment is so high. So when 140,000 people are not getting paid, you can imagine that the impact on the Strip overall, on the Gaza Strip overall, is devastating. And as you say, a huge component of that money belongs to the Palestinians themselves, and Israel simply says, well, we've decided to hold it for a while. Clear violations, but no one is holding Israel accountable.
I just want to go back for one sec to what you just said about the Geneva Conventions. When you said killing was not allowed, did you mean against a people under occupation?
Exactly. This
okay,
is in the Fourth Geneva Convention that sets out the obligations of an occupying power.
Can you just run those by us really quick, the obligations of an occupying power and how those are in contradiction to what Israel's doing now?
Well, essentially, the idea is that an occupied population is what is called a protected population. Article 3, Section 1A, prohibits, quote, violence to life and person, and, quote, prohibits murder of all kinds, period. Calling murder a targeted assassination doesn't make it legal. It's still murder. It's still illegal. Then the issue of collective punishment is crucial. Article 33 says, quote, no protected person can be punished for an offense he or she has not personally committed. Collective penalties and likewise all measures of intimidation or of terrorism are prohibited, period, end quote. That means that things like destroying a bridge or destroying a electrical generating plant on the grounds that a terrorist might use it is absolutely illegal. Absolutely illegal. In Article 36, it says the taking of hostages is prohibited. So that means that when Israel arrested a third of the Palestinian Legislative Assembly and half the cabinet ministers who are still being held, they're being held as bargaining chips for negotiations. There's no question about that. That's a direct violation of Article 36 of the Geneva Convention. So it goes on and on.
I want to talk about those that are still being held, the legislators that you mentioned, the Palestinian politicians that were taken by Israel and put in jail. I want to talk about that in a sec, but you're talking about the obligations of an occupying power, and didn't the occupation end in Gaza when the Israeli government pulled out the settlers a while back?
The occupation changed form last summer when the settlers and the soldiers were pulled out of the territory of Gaza. But in international law, occupation is defined as maintaining complete control of a territory. Israel still maintains complete control over Gaza. It controls the airspace, it controls the sea coast, it controls the borders and the border crossings, it controls the land underneath, and it has made clear, as it has done in the last 2 weeks, it maintains the right to re-enter Gaza at any moment. So there is no illusion that Gaza is sovereign or non-occupied. Technically, you might say it's gone from being a traditionally occupied territory to being a besieged territory. But again, under international law, a besieging power has exactly the same obligations and limitations on its own power as an occupying power. So Israel is bound by the Geneva Conventions in exactly the same way, whether or not its soldiers are inside the streets of Gaza or only on the borders of Gaza preventing anyone from leaving, preventing the rebuilding of the airport, which Israel bombed just as they bombed the Beirut airport, preventing the construction of a port that might make an independent Gazan economy possible. So all of those are Israeli obligations that they are not meeting and are therefore in violation of the Geneva Conventions.
And as you write in your talking points, in fact, since the so-called pullout, Gaza has remained besieged and surrounded by Israel. They've remained in complete control of all aspects of Gazan life, as we mentioned a moment ago, withholding 50 million or so Palestinian monthly tax revenues, controlling the Gaza economy, prohibiting workers from moving across the borders, and goods as well from moving,
right.
Controlling the airspace, coastal waters, the water supply, the seaport, preventing them from constructing a seaport or rebuilding the airport, continuing airstrikes and ground attacks on civilian infrastructure, as well as what they, you know, say are military targets. The civilian infrastructure has been heavily affected, correct?
Absolutely. The civilian infrastructure in Gaza was already rather in shambles after 35 years of military occupation. For example, the settlers used traditionally 40% of the water supply of the entire Gaza Strip, despite the fact that there were only 8,000 settlers as opposed to 1.3 million Palestinian residents in Gaza. So the infrastructure was already damaged. The the recent attacks on, particularly around Gaza City, on the bridges. There was just a crawler on CNN indicating that it appears that Israel has again targeted and hit the foreign ministry building of the Palestinian Authority. They've earlier destroyed the interior ministry and the prime minister's office in Gaza, which are all civilian targets, as well as bridges, as well as we mentioned earlier, the electrical generating plant. Numerous houses have been destroyed, greenhouses, groves of olive trees. There's been massive destruction of the infrastructure in Gaza.
I'm speaking with Phyllis Benish. She is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. Again, she recently issued some talking points on the crisis in Lebanon, Gaza, Israel. They are available at the Institute for Policy Studies website at ips-dc.org. I'll mention all this again at the end. Just a few minutes left here, and I want to get a couple more questions in. So you mentioned the Palestinian politicians, the legislators that were seized by Israel and are being held in jails, in Israeli jails right now. There's a lot of folks who would argue, well, they're members of Hamas, and Hamas is avowed to destroy the state of Israel. And so, you know, it's somehow legitimate to target them. Plus, it was apparently Hamas, the militant wing of Hamas, who captured the soldier and is currently holding him. So even if they were holding these legislators as bargaining chips, you know, so what would be some...
Well, the so what is international law. The so what is you're not allowed to hold people as bargaining chips, whether or not people they know might be responsible for something. Nobody claims that these guys were responsible for anything. This is the classic guilt by association notion, that because they may be members of an organization, they are somehow responsible for something they did not, as the Geneva Conventions that we just cited requires. They did not personally commit any act of violence. Nobody claims that they did. Also, if Israel were serious about wanting a stable Gaza that could govern itself and could function, what does it think is going to happen when half of the governing structures, half of the members of parliament and the cabinet itself are in jail, and the others are on the run because they don't know when they may be picked up as well? When the prime minister, Ismail Haniyeh, who was not among those arrested, made his last public statement, he did so, he was like taking a lesson from Dick Cheney, you know, speaking from an undisclosed location. He's on the run. How do they think the territory is supposed to be governed at a moment of extraordinary crisis? So this is not only illegal, it's also stupid. It's also incredibly stupid, to carry out this kind of an act.
Maybe they don't want it to be governed. Maybe they want to be able to point to it and say it's not being governed, therefore we need to
Indeed.
Be in charge.
Indeed.
I want to talk about Hamas's position, because it's actually changed quite a bit since they've become part of the political picture.
Absolutely. It's changed dramatically, even just in the last couple of weeks. Ismail Haniyeh had an extraordinary op-ed in the Washington Post about a week ago, in which he said specifically that the dream, I don't recall the word he used, but essentially that the dream of Palestinians was, the all of the land of historic Palestine, but that the goal, the political goal of Hamas and of his government is the end of the Israeli occupation of all land occupied in 1967, specifically identifying the 22% of historic Palestine that is widely understood as the basis for a two-state solution, what the U.S. and others claim Hamas would never accept. This is a very clear shift in their policy, a very important one, which has gotten virtually no recognition.
Why hasn't
it gotten
any
recognition?
Why hasn't it gotten any recognition?
I think it's because there's a value for the Bush administration, who are desperate to get the attention of the region away from the massive failure in Iraq. It's in the interest of the Israeli government that has an interest in claiming, as you were just saying, that Hamas is incapable of governing, etc. There are many forces, powerful forces in the world, who have an interest in denying that there is every basis for a for a negotiated settlement, but it has to be based on an end to Israeli occupation of the 67 territories. And until they're prepared to move forward on that, which Israel certainly is not, and the U.S. is prepared to back them up, they're not interested in any kind of a shift in Hamas, any willingness of Hamas to negotiate, because they don't want to negotiate on those terms.
Aside from the July 11th Washington Post op-ed by Palestinian Prime Minister and Hamas leader Haniyeh, where he states that the conflict could be resolved partly from statehood for the West Bank and Gaza, capital in Arab East Jerusalem, 67 borders, basically, Israel returning the 67 borders. Apart from that Washington Post op-ed by Hamas leader and Palestinian Prime Minister, what other developments are there that have demonstrated that Hamas is now entering into, a new position?
The most important one was their decision to participate in the political process in the occupied territories at all, because that implied a recognition that there was a different status of the 67 territories, the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, than of historic Palestine, meaning all of Palestine, including the territory of what is now Israel. That by itself was a major shift in the Hamas position. So, you know, there's a bunch of different steps. There have been also just in the Western press in the last several weeks, Ismail Haniyeh's was the most recent and in some ways the most explicit, but there have been other articles written by various Hamas leaders. There was one in the New York Times. There's been several others that have made their position very clear. They have never also, we should be clear, when they talked about their non-recognition of Israel, which they believe to be a religious obligation as well as a political position, that has never been defined as, so then we're going to throw all the Jews into the sea. You know, it's that's kind of the implication that people draw from the idea that they don't recognize Israel, that they want to destroy the people who live there. What it has always meant is both a religious commitment, you know, which I have no sympathy for, I must say, because I don't think religion should ever be the basis for determining political realities, but that's just me. But that is their view. But the other side of it is doing away with a system in which Palestinians are second or third or fourth class residents, not necessarily even citizens. So, the question of what comes later, what kind of a long-term vision would they have for some time in the future, they're now saying none of that has to be on the agenda any time in our lifetimes, that we're talking long-term. A long-term hudna, which means a ceasefire. There's another word in Arabic I'm forgetting at the moment that means a long-term calm. They use calm as a noun, a calm that would last for generations. So this is all, this is all out there in the public arena, but I'm afraid that the demonization of Hamas and the demonization of Islam, the demonization of Arabs, the demonization of Palestinians has gone so far that people in this country are often unable to get beyond kind of the rhetoric of their charter says calls for the end of Israel. You know, people don't necessarily have access to that information very easily, and they don't often take it seriously when they do see it.
Well, it's not just that. It's that Hamas, at least the militant wing, has participated in attacks on Israeli civilians.
They have indeed, and they should be condemned. But it's also true that Hamas has maintained a ceasefire for a year and a half. The attacks over the last 18 months have been carried out almost entirely by another organization completely, the Islamic Jihad, which is not connected to Hamas. It's a completely different organization, doesn't have a political wing. And the majority of those attacks have not been against Israeli civilians. There have been horrific attacks against Israeli civilians, which should and have been appropriately condemned. But some of those attacks, many of those attacks, have been against military targets inside the occupied territories. And while those are horrific on a human level, they are not the same in international law or any other law. They are military resistance, which is legal and necessary.
When you say military targets, you're not speaking about settlements, are you?
No, I'm talking about soldiers at checkpoints.
Okay.
And on occasion, armed settlers who are armed by the military and acting in a military capacity.
Acting as a paramilitary.
Indeed.
Just one final question for you today, Phyllis. What course should the major players in this situation take now? If you were, you know, I realize that they're probably not likely to take your advice, but just then the major...
Talk.
Right.
That's the advice. Talk.
This is for
stop
everyone?
Stop shooting everyone. Stop shooting. Stop sending rockets into cities. Stop bombing bridges. Stop bombing everything. Pull out of Gaza. Let people begin to heal and talk. That's the advice.
Well, what about people who would say, well, you know, you can't talk to Hezbollah. You can't talk to Hamas. What would
well,
you say
wrong.
To them?
They're wrong. Everybody has been talking to them. They have met diplomatically. They have sent diplomatic representatives all around the world. They have met with governments throughout Latin America, throughout Africa. It's not hard to talk to them.
Okay, so, you know, if all sides were to cease the fire and start talking, then what kind of solution do you think would...
Then you start looking at root causes. You start talking, and then you say, okay, how do we get past this ongoing conflict? What's the root of the conflict? My view is the root of the conflict is the Israeli occupation and its legacies. Hezbollah's first action in this recent upsurge, they claimed, I think they were wrong, but they claimed they were doing it to support the Palestinians in Gaza. The reason was that the level of desperation throughout Gaza was becoming unbearable for people who were watching it, for people who care about the Palestinians. I don't happen to think they did the Palestinians any good at all, but
yeah.
That was their stated motivation. So let's look beyond what they did, and let's look at why they did it, and let's stop the conditions that lead people to do it.
It's important to understand, too, that Hezbollah was born out of resistance to the Israeli occupation
exactly.
of southern Lebanon.
Very important point you made.
And that's part of the reason they have any popularity at all in Lebanon, is that they were viewed as the force that pushed Israel out.
Exactly, and they still have that credibility, more than the government of Lebanon at the moment. There still is a tiny disputed piece of territory that Lebanon claims belongs to it, and Israel continues to occupy the Sheba Farms, right at the point where the Lebanese and Syrian and Israeli borders all come together. But nonetheless, the goal should be stop shooting and let's talk.
And if you think that the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza is the root, then maybe you could say what you think the Israeli and, more importantly, or equally as importantly, the U.S. government should do. Should they enter into talks with Hamas, considering the shift in
the talks have to be regional talks. It isn't only Hamas that's involved. Hamas is part of the leadership, the majority leadership of the Palestinian Authority, which has a little bit of control of only one component of the Palestinian people. Those who live under Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. They don't represent or govern or speak for the 20% of the Palestinian Israeli population who are Palestinians, and the several million Palestinian refugees that are scattered around the world. All of those components need to be taken into account for serious negotiations. Hamas is a part of it, but only a part of it. There need to be serious negotiations aimed at implementing international law and human rights for everybody, for Palestinians, for Israelis, for everyone in the region. That means relying on UN resolutions, all the UN resolutions, not just the hand-picked few, all the UN resolutions and all the international law. That should be the basis of a just and lasting solution.
Again, I've been speaking with Phyllis Benes. She is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. And you can read her recently issued talking points on this crisis that we've been discussing in Lebanon, Israel, and Gaza at ips-dc.org. Thanks so much for joining me today, Phyllis. I really appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Thanks very much.
Take care. So again, that was Phyllis Benes. Read her talking points at the Institute for Policy Studies website at ips-dc.org.